All right, and I think we should be live here. Everybody's in the chat. Chat's going. Evil has sunglasses. I know him from the Substack. This usual crowd is back again for another classic movie stream, and it's nice to see you all. I'll just let everybody filter in for a little bit, and we're back. First Bond, I remember watching Christmas '84, maybe aged eight. Yeah, so can you give me a okay in the chat if I'm coming through okay? Yeah, I can see it now. We're up and running. You know, there's a lot of crazy things going on out there at the moment, and I'll tell you what, Endeavor, I was overjoyed to watch this. You know, when you see all the world falling apart and all the madness going on. And I thought, because I mentioned it the last time, the last classic movies we did last month was the end of, like, quite literally the end of the world, and we got into nihilism and existentialism and cannibalism and the world like dying and all this. And I thought, right, I'm gonna let's have something a bit lighthearted next time. So I picked this one, and then when I watched it again, I was thinking, God, this is so cozy. Like, everything in the world makes sense. Everything I get, there's babes in it as well. Remember what a sexy babe looked like? You've got like a big goon that can't die. You've got Roger Moore winking and making innuendo. You've got little parodies of Lawrence of Arabia. This is kind of like the perfect Bond movie. Because another thing is, like, I get that everybody will say, "Oh, well, Sean Connery is the real Bond and everything," and I think that, yeah, it is. But all of the things that have been built up, all the little tropes and everything, like because when I suggested this, The Spy Who Loved Me, it was kind of off the top of my head. It was just on the next of a list of Bond movies. And then when I looked into it a little bit more, I began to think, yeah, all of the sort of the quintessential James Bond tropes are in this one, and it's got a great soundtrack by Carly Simon. I think the Bond girl's beautiful, and I think Roger Moore's great. He's not yet too old. I thought this was absolutely fantastic. What did you think of The Spy Who Loved Me? Welcome to the stream, Endeavor. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, and I absolutely loved The Spy Who Loved Me. I'm a big James Bond fan, like most guys, I assume. I would say that I am a bit more of a Connery guy, but I think Roger Moore is a very close second. And of the Roger Moore movies, this one, in my opinion, is his best. If I had to make a list of my top or of my Bond movies from best to worst, I'd say Spy Who Loved Me is probably number three on my list. I might put Thunderball and From Russia with Love slightly above it, but suffice to say, I absolutely love The Spy Who Loved Me. I think it is, like, as you said, the quintessential James Bond movie, and it has everything that we love about James Bond in it. It's fun. It's action packed, has beautiful women, Bond, and Roger Moore just does a phenomenal job. And well, I guess it just gives you, I guess it's just one of the reasons that everyone loves James Bond and the character is so iconic. So yeah, great choice.
I never knew it before, you know, because you do a little bit of background research and you want to have your takes in order and things for when we do these things. And I didn't realize it, but this was kind of make or break for the Bond franchise. Because what had happened, of course, I think this was the second movie that Roger Moore had done,
It was the third.
the third. And the previous one, particularly The Man with the Golden Gun, they just weren't going down that well. Because obviously Sean Connery had dropped out, and then they tried to carry on with Roger Moore. But one of the problems that they had was, if you look at something like Man with the Golden Gun, like he kind of pins a woman down and he slaps her around a bit. And the writers realized that the problem they had was that they were writing Roger Moore to be Sean Connery when he wasn't. I mean, I don't think Roger Moore's as physically sort of intimidating as Sean Connery is, or as kind of brutal and just general kind of hard bastard. He's Sean Connery's much more suave and a much more of a kind of, you know, you see the innuendo coming in, you see a bit of humor coming in. He comes across as a bit more of a toff than what Sean Connery does. And so on The Spy Who Loved Me, they actually wrote that. They actually wrote it in such a way where it would benefit Roger Moore and not be kind of trying to turn him into Sean Connery. So that's when you get these, like the classic one-liners coming in here as well. I mean, another thing is, like, before we get into the movie itself, like, let's just start with the intro is when, like, he's in a hut, and then he's in an alpine hut lodge.
He's in the Alps in Austria.
Yeah, with a beautiful woman, and she says, but I need you, and he says, well, so does England. And then there's the famous skiing sequence where he jumps out at the end and he's got the Union Jack as the parachute. And I thought, that's it. That's what they're doing. It's going to be patriotic. It's going to be a little bit of innuendo in there. There's a little side of inside jokes, which was safe for the kids. And then you're going to get a more kind of upbeat. I mean, to be fair, it's not like the Sean Connery stuff was downbeat. Like, there was there was innuendo in that as well. Well, like, my name's Plenty O'Toole, and he says, named after your father, perhaps, all of this kind of thing. So it wasn't that much of a change, you know what I mean? But they did, I think, lighten things up again for Roger Moore, and the eyebrow looking, kind of sort of looking at the audience to make sure they got the jokes and this kind of thing. And I think it's great. I think the theme tune's great. I think the bad guy, Stromberg, is probably one of the weaker ones. But, you know, we can get into that. Have you got any other takes before we get into the plot?
Well, I mean, there's also it's worth bringing up the theme song as well. It was a pretty successful song in its own right, I heard, back in the day. So the theme song for this one, it's basically about I think the actual title of the theme song is Nobody Does It Better, but you know, it has the phrase "The Spy Who Loved Me" in the theme song, and it was written for the movie, like all of them are. But it's basically just about James Bond being the ultimate Chad. Even though there's a possible interpretation of it, could it actually be about Triple X's lover who Bond kills in the opening sequence? But yeah, I the theme song is another pretty good one, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think even the title is kind of a little bit ambiguous, because one of the sort of the plot line is that Agent X, the Russian agent, the girl, Anya. She's James Bond at the start of it. He gets chased down the side of a mountain, and you know that it's an important sequence because the camera lingers on it. And he's got like his what do you call them, ski sticks? What are they called?
Ski poles.
Ski pole. He shoots one of that. He's got it's like a harpoon, and he shoots him with it. And you can tell that this is going to matter later because the camera makes sure that you remember it. And then, of course, that's her boyfriend. And there's the sequence where they wake up in bed once you get underway. And this is going to come back. So the title is, you can kind of think it may be her boyfriend, or it could be from James Bond's perspective, and it's that the girl loves him or whatever. That's just the general theme of the movie itself. And then you get into the first act, which, as usual, you know, like, we were just talking about this off air, but I think when I watched when I watched James Bond movies growing up, I really didn't have much of a clue what was going on. You know, like the actual details of the plot. So it's usually about, like, this person has a micro film, and that's what it is in this. And then you're going to have to meet up with somebody else. You're going to have to get the microfilm off him, but he's only got half of it, so you have to get the other person, but the other person's been murdered, and then that leads you on, and then you've just had your half of it. So, and it's all of this, and you just think, I haven't got a clue what's going on, but I don't really care. Like I'm just gonna go with it. I'm just gonna ride it out because it really doesn't matter. I don't think you've got to take the storylines too seriously at all. But in this era, the earlier era, like it was pretty dense and complicated, I think. But when you watch the Daniel Craig ones now, they're not complicated at all. Like there's no it's very linear and straightforward, and like there's big signs telling you who's doing what and why and all of this kind of thing. But in this one, you just kind of go with it. You just kind of go, you know, you're on the ride, and it doesn't really, because most of these people are just goons who are going to be killed anyway. So the first major kind of, the first act is in Egypt, and Egypt looks great. And we get it because like Roger Moore's white and he goes to the desert, they have to dress him up as Lawrence of Arabia. And then, you know, it's like whenever a white man has to go in the desert, he's Lawrence of Arabia. And as I say, they're running around, they're chasing after the microfilm. And then he meets up with the Russian agent, the Russian beauty. And then they're introduced to the most, I would say, the most famous and iconic John Bond goon of all time, which is Jaws. I thought he was in a lot of Bond movies, but apparently he was only in this and Moonraker.
He was in two of them.
I thought he was in a lot more than that, but yeah, he was just, it feels like he's in all of the Roger Moore ones, even though he isn't. He's just in the two of them. And I mean, he's great. He Richard Keeley pops up in some other things. He popped up in Pale Rider as well. Remember when we did the Pale Rider classic movies?
Yes.
Yeah, so he was the big goon in that as well. but in this one, he's at his peak. And he does come across as indestructible. Unlike other Bond goons, he doesn't die either. He just brushes things off, which adds like a nice touch. And he's like a kind of Terminator.
Yeah, every movie in the 70s and 80s, especially Bond movies, they had to have some big guy for the hero to punch. They had this in Rambo, they had this in Indiana Jones, and of course they had it in James Bond. There's always the main villain, and then there's the guy that the hero just like gets into fist fights with. And I think that Richard Keel is just the perfect one. I don't think that in reality, a giant 6-7 foot tall guy with metal teeth who has to go up to people and bite them would be the most efficient assassin, but who cares? You know, it's a James Bond movie, and he makes for some great action sequences. And I also like that, you know, he's kind of this intimidating, he's this like intimidating villain, but also at the same time, he's kind of this comic relief. So it kind of adds like another lighthearted aspect. So every time that James Bond gets into a fight with Jaws, Jaws always like falls off of a bridge or crashes his car or gets thrown off of a train or something. And they always just have him get up, rush himself off, and then walk away. It's great.
He literally does just brush himself off and then come after him again. I always love the sequence. There's one sequence in it when they're in Egypt, and what it is, because that the Anya and Bond, there's a bit of a cat and mouse sort of angle to it, and she double crosses Bond and steals the microfilm and leaves him to face Jaws by himself. And then he knocks a sort of rafter down and just buries Jaws loads of concrete and logs and building materials. But Bond's got the keys to the like a minibus they've got, and so she cannot escape. So he gets in and gives her the keys, and Jaws arrives and starts tearing the van apart. And Bond is like sitting there, he's mansplaining to her like what gear to put it in, and he's pointing out that the noise of the gearbox is making all kind. Can you play another tune? And then he even says like women drivers and puts his head. And meanwhile, Jaws is just tearing the vehicle apart. It's just a class moment. All of these things you can't do anymore, of course, because it's based on like it's obviously kind of misogynistic. You know what I mean? But Yeah, I love it. As soon as you see that kind of thing and the kind of the sideways glance to the camera, you'd say, this is class. This is class stuff.
I mean, one difference between the Connery and the Moore films is that the Moore films kind of have a bit more feminism in them, in that the women, they actually usually help Bond in some ways. So in this one, Agent Triple X, she's a Soviet agent of her own. In Moonraker, the woman in that one is an American CIA agent, and in what's it called, For Your Eyes Only, it's some like badass girl with this crossbow. In the Connery ones, they're kind of a bit more ditzy. They're kind of they're a lot more like they don't help Bond on the mission quite as much. But what I do love, though, in the Moore ones, at the end, you know, they all still fall head over heels for the Chad, and you know, at the end of the movie, it's like, okay, yeah, that's cute, but you know, Bond is still the man.
Yeah, Connery, the Bond girls and the Connery ones, like, he really does speak to them like they're all like 17-year-old girls, doesn't he? And in Goldfinger, there's the famous scene where one of them's in a bikini. And he's about to talk business with Goldfinger at the swimming pool. And the girl comes over and she says something like ditzy and daft. And Connery like slaps her on the arse and winks at her and tells her to go away. And he just says, go and get yourself a drink. There's man talk happening here.
Yeah. It was with Felix Leiter, but yeah.
Yeah. And then we move on to the second sort of act. There's a bit more skullduggery and shenanigans go on in Egypt, and then we move on to the second act, which takes place in and around Sardinia, and we're introduced to the main villain. I mean, I will say as well, and then we get the Lotus is how do you pronounce it? Esprit?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's French sounding anyway, but you get the famous car. I've probably got it in me photos here somewhere. And then we find out, like, just to get into the main plot, Stromberg. This is another thing, like, because what's happened is the Soviet Union and the British Secret Services are facing a threat, so they've teamed up together. Then usually there'll be like enemies in this, but in this one they've teamed up. And did you notice how like they had to team up against a German? They had to team up against Klaus Schwab. Many of the Bond villains are Germans.
Uh huh. Yeah, it's always some kind of continental European.
And they've agreed to sort of it's just a sort of excuse to have Bond go on an adventure with his sort of opposite number, who's a Russian agent who's like really beautiful and that kind of thing. And in Sardinia itself, I thought looked gorgeous. You know, I mean, we'll get onto this kind of deeper dives a bit later on, but I just think everywhere they went in this, they look absolutely great. But the main plot of the bad guy is that he is a German, of course, so he's a shipping magnate. He's one of the richest men in the world. And Anya, the Russian agent, she gets a little jibe in about how he's like one of the major capitalist exploiters of the world. And like Roger Moore sort of raises his eyes, you know what I mean? He's like, oh god, here we go. But he's got a plot. He's stealing nuclear submarines from the Russians. He's got one from the Russians and one, he's a British one that he steals. And he's got an eye on getting a third one from the Americans. And he's going to launch their nukes at Moscow and New York, which will trigger a nuclear war. And then, like, what, he's going to survive by himself in his underwater sort of giant, it's not even a city, it's a fair size, but like I'm not jumping ahead because this is kind of revealed more or less in the second act, and I just think his plan's kind of weird because he's going to destroy the world so that again he can live in his underground underwater city, like what, with Jaws, and a bunch of goons in red jumpsuits. He doesn't he doesn't even have any women planned or anything. It's just, I'm going to destroy the world and sit down here and just look at the fish.
Also, how's he going to run the, how's he going to run his new civilization if he's destroyed all of the manufacturing base and all the natural resources and everything? You know, I mean, I imagine that an underwater city would cost a lot of money to run. You'd need a lot of resources. You'd need a lot of personnel. You'd need all that stuff to run this. How's he going to, how's he planning on doing this if there's a nuclear holocaust? I don't know, but I mean, I guess the great thing about the movie is that you don't even care because it's just so entertaining that it, obviously the villain's plot just makes no sense whatsoever. it makes no sense whatsoever. But I guess the beauty of The Spy Who Loved Me is, and James Bond in general, is that it's so entertaining that it doesn't even matter that, you know, you're just so into the action that you don't even need to really think about how his plan would actually make sense.
Yeah, I just find it a bizarre plan, to be honest. He's like, why even nuke the world if you're just going to sit on your underground city? You don't need to nuke the world to do that. You can just do it. You could just do it anyway. There it is on the screen as well. The Strongberg's Atlantis for underground. So his all right. So whatever, for whatever reason, the chat's pointed out that he's not German. He's Swedish as well. So there we go.
I think the actor's German, but I think the character might have been Swedish.
And so his plan is to nuke the world and live on this kind of weird spider underground city with Jaws and a bunch of men in red jumpsuits for the rest of time and look at the fish or something like that. And this doesn't go according to plan. Then we get into the third act when it really kicks off. James Bond, in a hair-raising scene, frees the sailors from the submarines, and then he fires off the nukes, and he does it so that they target each other. And this is another thing, because there's like nuclear explosions going off in the Atlantic on the Barents Sea or something. This is already a disaster. Like, this is already really bad news if you've got these. But yeah, whatever. That's how they save the day. And then he ends up keeping the British end up, bouncing around with Anya, and they're rescued. And that's kind of the plot. I've skipped over a lot because we can come back to it as well.
Well, I just want to add that I think that the third act of this movie is probably my favorite of any Bond movie. I think it is my favorite climax because I just love the battle scene in the tanker. So the big tanker, which what this thing does is that it's this giant ship which basically eats the submarine. So that the way that Stromberg captured these submarines was he sails up behind them, and then there's a huge hatch on the front that opens up and just kind of like swallows the submarines, and that's how he got the first the British and then the Russian and then in the third act the American submarine. The crews of these three submarines are in the brig of this giant tanker. Bond frees them, and then they get to the armory, and then the British, Russian, and American crews have to work together to fight off Stromberg's henchmen in orange jumpsuits. And it's this great scene, this great firefight of them trying to get into the control room, where they then order the two submarines to launch the nuclear weapons at each other, blowing each other up. And following that scene, Bond then goes to Strongberg's base, which is called Atlantis, and then he goes there to save Triple X, to save Anya, because the American sub has been ordered to sink the base. So they've been ordered to fire torpedoes at it and sink it. And Bond says, "Well, give me 45 minutes. I'll get her out." And then, you know, of course, he goes there, he shoots Strongberg, and then he gets into a fight with Jaws. There's the great scene where he throws Jaws into the shark tank, and Jaws bites the shark. And then, you know, of course, at the end, he ends up with him and Anya escape on Strongberg's escape pod. And then there's the famous scene, at the end. I will say that it's also interesting that there's the plot point that Anya actually swore that she would kill Bond after the mission was over. Since officially they were working together, their governments had instructed them that they must work together to finish this mission. But at the beginning of the movie, Bond had killed her lover. So she promises, she says to him that once the mission is over, she's going to kill him. And then they're in the escape pod, and she pulls out a gun and says, "The mission's over." And then instead of shooting Bond, she shoots the cork off of a champagne bottle. And then I think you know the rest. It's a James Bond ending. Bond and a beautiful woman in this little escape pod with pillows and champagne floating in the ocean. I think you get the idea. One thing I wanted to add was that I think there is kind of like this truth about women in this scene too. Like, remember, this is the man who killed the man that she loved. But you know, at the end of the day, she still couldn't resist Chad Roger Moore, even after he had killed the man that she loved. You know, it says a lot.
Because they're both soaking wet, and then he says, like, what is it? She says something like, "Have you got any last words?" Which is always a bad idea. Like,
well, I think that the line was, he said, isn't a condemned man entitled to a last request?
And then he says, and she says, "Go on," or so, "Yeah, okay." And then he says, let's get out of these wet clothes, shall we? And she just gives a smile as if to say, "Yeah, let's." And you think, "Oh, what a bloke, what a man!" But I mean, I will say, like, there's three beautiful women get whacked in this movie quite brutally. And there's the first one, because we should go back a little bit, because at the start of it, you see that Stromberg has got a lift in his underground city, his underwater city, and he pushes the button, and then there's like this woman who's been leaking information, and she falls down a chute, and she goes into the shark tank, and then you see that the tiger shark actually balls at the pieces, because this is the thing is, though, you don't actually see any blood. But then later, when James Bond arrives in the lair, you actually see her arm on the bottom of the seabed thing or what outside, like the shark or whatever it is.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, James Bond spots it when he's doing his usual kind of trying to outwit Stromberg. And he's deliberately needling him and kind of manipulating him to give him more weight. But he glances down, he sees that there's like a woman's arm on the bottom of the seabed where what's left. And there's fish pecking at it as well. And then there's a scene in Egypt when there's a sort of a belly dancer. I love how they sort of... You know how these days when you hear about racial stereotypes and everything, I just love how, like, James Bond goes to Egypt and he has to get dressed up as an Arab. They play the Lawrence of Arabia soundtrack, and then you've got an Egyptian who looks very white to be an Egyptian belly dancer. If you actually look at the Egyptian people, like, these days, I don't have the picture handy, but they don't look like that. Like, I mean, she looked like she was from the south of France or something. Like, she didn't look like what Egyptian women look like. But at any rate, James Bond's having a bit of carry on with her as well, enjoying the, what does he say, diving into the treasures of Egypt or something like that. And she gets shot in the back. And then a little bit later, during the famous chase scene when they're in the Lotus, Another woman who was established earlier from Strongberg's new kind of bimbo, they go off the end of a jetty, the car turns into a submarine, and then they fire a rocket up and blow up yet another beautiful woman in the helicopter. And I was thinking, man, I tell you what, like, it's a bit rough on the old bimbos, this one, isn't it? They're just getting whacked. Because especially the shark one, that's quite unusual. Now, again, the one to PG rating or whatever what it was at the time, so it's not like you see a screaming. It's not like Jaws. By the way, Jaws came out just 2 years before this, and you can clearly see they're leaning into Spielberg's Jaws. So as you can clearly see, there's like, you've got the shark in there, you've got Jaws himself. And then when the Lotus comes back out of the water and starts to transform into a car again, they shoot it in such a way that it actually looks like the way that Spielberg, you know, would shoot Jaws. So where you're looking at it from above the water, and you can see there's something in the water, and it's coming towards the people on the beach, and all the people on the beach begin to panic. But it's James Bond's car, not an actual shark. But it's a little nod and a wink to that film. And then the window comes down and he drops a fish out, of course. And so that brings me kind of up to speed. And the what I will say, it's quite brutal. I was quite shocked at that scene with the shark killing that girl. Like, and another, Jaws himself as well. Like, the way Jaws actually kills people, because I hadn't seen this in ages, and Jaws doesn't just like beat people or crunch people up. He's got like this weird thing where he like bites their necks like a vampire or something. But they're sparing with the blood, but it's quite violent. Like, it is quite what's implied by that.
Yeah, I guess like the one scene, like when during the car chase in Italy, when Bond blows up the helicopter, which was flown by Strongberg's new girlfriend, that was one that I was actually surprised. I think is Bond really gonna kill her? Is he really gonna kill a woman that beautiful? And I just like the part where he's like, it's time to say goodbye to an unwanted guest, and then he just launches the missile. That chase scene is great as well. There are so many of them. I think my favorite line in the movie is during that chase scene when one of the baddies on a motorcycle drives right through a truck carrying pillows, and he gets all these feathers on him, and then Bond like knocks him off the cliff, and as he's falling, Roger Moore just says, "All those feathers, and he still can't fly." I kind of think that's kind of quintessential Roger Moore. Like, he has this wit that, and now Sean Connery had it too, but I feel with Roger Moore, he feels like he's a bit more witty, you know? He feels like he's having a bit more fun, and is a bit less serious than Sean Connery.
Yeah, he's less of a bruiser than Connery, but he's much more suave. Like I say, you get the impression that he's kind of very upper middle class, whereas with Connery, especially because of some of the other films he did, like The Hill, you get the impression that Connery sort of kicked and punched his way up through the ranks, whereas Connery's kind of come out of Oxford. I know that's
with Moore has come out of Oxford.
Yeah, Moore has come out of. He's more elite leaning. He's more.
Oh yeah. He's kind of like the English gentleman of the 20th century. I don't know if I would say he would be in place in, say, Victorian England, but yeah, he definitely represents the high culture of Britain in the 20th century, and kind of the residual prestige from the empire. So this was true with Connery as well, but I think that Moore kind of captures the whole like gentlemanly upper class aristocratic type a bit better. With Bond, what are some things that he loves? He loves gambling. He loves five-star hotels. He loves fine suits. He loves caviar, famously his vodka martinis, shaken, not stirred. He's a representative of high culture. So he's not just a hero who goes around punching bad guys. He also has class and culture. And that's one of the reasons why I think he's so likable.
Yeah, there's a little bit of inside info on the, like a little bit of deep lore on the Lotus itself, was that because usually there was the Aston Martin, and it was rumor got out that they were looking for another car for this one. Because they, like I said earlier, they wanted to really make a splash with this one. They went all out with this one because they were beginning to worry about the franchise. And Lotus got wind of it, and then they parked that white Lotus Esprit outside of Pinewood Studios deliberately so that Cubby Broccoli would see it, and he did, and he was like, okay, this is the Bond car, like this is where we're gonna go. And it is like really an iconic car as well, isn't it?
Oh yeah, I really like this car. I mean, I know the Aston Martin is the most iconic one, but this one I thought was cool. And you know, I do think that the car also really fit the underwater sequences. So the trick with this car is that it can turn into a submarine and drift around underneath the water. That just wouldn't have worked with the aesthetics of the Aston Martin. I think they got the perfect car for that.
Yeah, they did. And I mean, what I like about this is that, because obviously James Bond, the backdrop to James Bond is the Cold War. And they kind of flip the script on this one, because they make the Soviets, to sort of quote another Cold War line from John Le Carre, is that the Soviets come in from the cold in a way in this one. I think in the real world, they were trying to sort of de-escalate. By the time you get into the late 70s, it would ramp up again in the 80s, but you get into the heading towards the era of detente and all of this kind of thing. And later on in Octopussy, they would actually have like a rogue Soviet general as the main bad guy and not the actual Soviet Union itself. So it was as if it was preparing the way for this. Whereas in the earlier ones, it was just that the Soviets were just evil. And I think that adds a nice dynamic, because I think there's a kind of golden era.
Was it though? Because in From Russia with Love, the Soviets weren't evil. The woman who was the Russian woman was working for Spectre.
Which woman? The one with the poisoned knife in a boot?
Yeah, she wasn't actually working. She was a double agent. She betrayed the USSR and started working for Spectre.
Right. Okay. So what I like about this is that when you've got the wider backdrop of the Cold War, it kind of leans into having a nice romantic feel, because you've got everything set in place. You know that it's kind of Eastern Europe is a dark totalitarian place. You know that the West are kind of the good guys. And so when they begin to sort of coordinate and help each other out, I think it adds depth to it. Whereas the same will go for something like John Le Carre's novels as well, where you get this sort of the Secret Service helping each other out and scratching each other's backs, though when they're facing the public, they're not getting on very well at all. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. So they like publicly they had their enemies, but then you know behind the scenes they're kind of like, okay, well, what are you guys up to? Well, we're up to this. What are you guys going to do? Yeah, I mean, I do like that. I do like that element of the film as well. I think that, I mean, nobody remembers the plot of James Bond movies. It's always the action sequences. But I did think it was kind of a cool setup that he's working with he has to work with a Soviet agent, and the two of them have to come together to stop this rogue billionaire megalomaniac. You also notice that the guy who plays the general, so the character's name is General Gogol. He's actually in a lot of the movies. So he's actually a recurring character. So he was this was the first one he was in as the general. He was in a he was in one of the Connery movies in a different role, but he basically turns up in I think six movies in a row, starting with this one and actually going into the Timothy Dalton ones. And he basically represents the what the Soviet Union is doing. So he represents what's going on the other side of the Cold War. I'd say that the Cold War is like a lot more pronounced in the Moore films, which is kind of surprising, because with the Connery films, it's Spectre. So Spectre is the villain in all of them except for Goldfinger. Bond is up against Spectre. I can't remember with Diamonds Are Forever because I haven't seen that one in a long time. But with the Moore films, it's typically set on the backdrop of the Cold War, and then something goes on, and it's usually some kind of third rail or whatever that's trying to play the two sides against each other. and Bond has to kind of get in there and prevent the two sides from coming to blows or something like that. So that, I mean, that this is the first one that really kind of fits into that mold, and I think it was also the one that did it the best.
Yeah, it is. And what I was going to say earlier as well, when you see Saw Dinya in this, and it gets into that kind of golden era that I was talking about, because Saw Dinya in this looks just looks lovely. It just looks a lovely place to live. And you think, how was any of this improved by globalism? Do you know what I mean? Like, why exactly did we need that? Is it better now than what it was in James Bond? Because I'm not really buying it. And I think another angle on this, especially sort of with Egypt, is that I think it does give you a kind of nice, it is pure escapism. But, you know, do you think Egypt was as nice as what it's portrayed as in James Bond? I mean, I don't think you can kind of just ride over a sand dune and the pyramids are just there in the middle of a desert. There's like, have you seen those pictures of what Cairo looks like and it just stretches on forever?
I know what you mean. Yeah,
I'm torn. I'm torn on the one hand because I think it is an idealized, romantic sort of vision. But on the other hand, it's in this sort of pre-globalized world where the world still had a bit of mystery to it. It still had an allure. You could still, like, you know, especially when you're talking about this, people wouldn't have actually been exposed to that ancient Egyptian architecture when this movie came out so much, except on TV documentaries here and there. And you wouldn't have got to see what life was like on like a Sardinian fish market and this kind of thing, and it all looks wonderful, and you think, well, was it though? You know what I mean? I'm kind of torn between these idealistic representations of what a place would look like, but on the other hand, I think they look so nice. Like, why do we even need globalism then? Do you see the sort of the binary there?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think if you went to the actual real Sardinia today, objectively, like, even if you went there, say, 47 years ago when this came out, I think it would have Sardinia would have been a better place when this movie came out. I don't think they're kind of lying too much about how nice it would have been.
I imagine that too. I mean, I can't imagine it being better with the current trends that are going on. But I also really love the scenery in the movie as well. The scenes with Sardinia are beautiful. The scenes with Egypt are beautiful. I even like the underwater sequences. I know a lot. One criticism people have of this movie and of Thunderball, which is also one of my favorite James Bond films, is that they don't like the underwater sequences. This one doesn't have quite as many. And most of the underwater sequences are of him in the car. So there's still dialogue and everything. But I've always really liked those sequences. I like all of the Bond movies which have some kind of theme of water. I don't know why, but I find that it just kind of has that backdrop. I just kind of like the ones that are set underwater in some way. And then there's also the great scenes of when they go into Atlantis, and then outside of his window you see all these fish and everything like that. Now that's another thing. Like, if you were in the middle of the ocean, would it actually look like an aquarium outside of the window? Probably not. But it makes for a good set, though.
I mean, I've been snorkeling in the Mediterranean around Greece, and there is a lot of fish. It is very, very clear, pristine water with fish everywhere, at least where I was. I was in Zakynthos about 20 years ago. And this is why as well, I can understand why they wanted to have Atlantis in the Mediterranean. Because on the one hand, I can't think of it, because I don't think the Mediterranean is very deep. But on the one hand, I can... And it would be really easy to find and then surround because it's just a massive lake. On the one hand, though, I can see like why it's not a good plan. But on the other hand, in terms of making a film, it really lends itself to it because it is very nice, especially where it was shot. Whereas if you can you imagine if it was in the actual Atlantic and it was like down next to the Titanic or something, and it was all dark, and like, you had storms and squalls and all, and the waves were like huge, and like it's genuinely wild. So I can kind of understand why they do it, but the Mediterranean does have a lot of nice spots like that. I'm not saying like it's just you look out the window and it's just like an aquarium. Like they did lay it on a little bit, but it is quite nice like that. It is quite nice like that. I mean, to move on to the other Bonds, then 45 minutes in, I think on the main plots and everything, it's a James Bond movie. What are you going to do? It's like just enjoy the ride, you know. And all of it, what we've been discussing so far, kind of it all adds up to a people would kind of balk at wholesome. Would you say, Jim, that like this one we're talking about, would you say it's wholesome or would you say it's degenerate? Because I think it's wholesome. But I remember a while ago, I was on Twitter or something. I can't remember where it was. But somebody pushed back against like how we think of James Bond being a hero, and they were saying the you know who's control the media, and James Bond has been amplified because he's a white man who isn't married, doesn't have kids, he drinks too much, and he's this kind of sort of a murderer on behalf of the state and all of that. And I just thought, oh god, here we go. Like, you know, welcome to this kind of postmodern sort of white nationalism sort of thing where everything has to be deconstructed. Yeah. Everything has to be broken down and kind of smashed apart. So you can't even just enjoy a bloody James Bond movie anymore. And this isn't the left. It's not a leftist way of thinking. The left have got their own criticisms of James Bond. And they began to pop up sort of more seriously in the Pierce Brosnan ones, which we can probably get into. But I just thought this idea where, yeah, he isn't like a family man 2.0 kid, or he doesn't have a homestead or something, or he's not like a trad calf. So it's just all rubbish. It's just all trash, and your mind's being poisoned with it. And I just think, oh God, it's so tiresome. You know?
No, I mean, like, I don't know if I'd call James Bond wholesome per se, but I'd say it's fun and it's good. Safe, action packed fun. So, I mean, I don't think people need to think about it that deeply, because, here's an example of why James Bond could actually be wholesome is that, what you see with a lot of the heroes in pop culture is that they're these universalists. So someone like Superman. And yes, everyone knows who made Superman. We don't need to write it in the comments. We already know about that. He's like this like fish out of water. He's not really human. He's an outsider, and he's kind of just out for all of humanity. Well, with James Bond, he's a hero who has a country. He's a patriot, and he's serving king and country. And and also the other thing is that he's quintessentially British. So. I mean, James Bond, the character, has a universal appeal, but he does come from one culture in particular. It doesn't feel the same as a lot of the cape shit that we get today, where it's just something that's just made for a global audience. It's just coming from nowhere and trying to appeal to everyone, but appeals to no one. I think that one of the reasons that James Bond was so iconic is that he is a reflection of Britain in the mid 20th century. So you know, I don't have any issues with James Bond. And let's be honest, like it's a fantasy. Now fantasies don't actually have to line up with reality. I mean, James Bond, he's the fantasy that every man wants to be him. He's the ultimate Chad. He's good looking. He's smart. He's brave, and he gets all the beautiful women in the world. And every woman wants to be with a man like James Bond. I mean, he literally has a license to kill. Now, let's be honest here. Every man kind of has a bit of an infatuation with violence. It's kind of just in our warrior instinct, I guess you could say. And James Bond, I'd say he's kind of the 20th century's version of Hercules or Achilles or something like that. He's just this, a kind of an archetype of what every man wishes he could be. Of course, you can't actually be James Bond. Just like, you know, you can't go around screwing every woman under the sun and just, you know, face no consequences. You also can't go around, blowing things up and getting into, like, think about how much damage would have been done by any of these car chases. Or you mentioned about the nuclear bombs going off in the ocean. But with James Bond, you don't need to think about that. It's just kind of this fun adventure of and escapism. And I don't know, it's just, like, the idea that, like, it's subversive, I just totally reject that. We can have things that are fun, you know. Let's not get into the no fun, right? And well, it's with Bond, you can see why every man wants to be him based on the picture on the screen.
Yeah, that's what James Bond's about, right there on the screen. I'm not gonna knock it. I will say though, when one of the takes on it is interesting, because, you know, in the James Bond era, I have never read any of the books, but you've obviously got to deal with the fact that Britain had lost the empire and was drastically reduced in its influence and power in the world, and that we're kind of just these lackeys of the American empire now, you know. And I think James Bond, in this one as well, when this came out, and you got the famous scene of jumping off the cliff with the Union Jack parachute opening, and then it's kind of like, yeah, we're back. It's like a bit of British patriotism, and it's for Queen and country. I'd like to stay here and get back into bed with you, but England needs me too. And that's fine. But it's a sort of post empire cope though for Britain, but still it was like a global it was targeted for the British. It is of a British sort of identity, navigating Britishness after World War II, after the empire and everything like that. And the rest of the world can clearly kind of think, yeah, they're still in the game. They're still a people, sort of, you know, they've still got clout. They've still got these people who go around and do these. Like, this is what they're about these days. They're not just dwindling away. But in reality, you know, you look at the economic situations and it was just everybody rioting on the streets and everything in the 60s and 70s. Well, in the 70s anyway, when this came out, the country was in quite bad shape. I mean, I'm not sure if it was in such a bad shape as what it is now, but you get all of those sort of, you know, the bin men would go on strikes, and the money was, there was mass unemployment and all of this kind of thing. And so James Bond was pure escapism for a country on its knees, and at the same time, managing to sell Britain to the world, sort of managing to say, well, we're still here and we're still cool. James Bond's kind of like Cool Britannia before it became a thing in the 90s with Britpop and Tony Blair and everything like that.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think there's nothing wrong with some good, fun, lighthearted patriotism and to get people excited about their country again. Especially, I mean, I obviously don't know nearly as much about it as you do, because I'm not British, but you know, to give people a bit of optimism, I think that's always a good thing. So no, anyone that says like Bond is subversive, no, just get out of here. Like, there's a lot worse things out there than James Bond. I think that it's one of those things that it's good, fun entertainment, which everyone can enjoy. And I don't think it's, I mean, maybe it might be offensive to like some sensibilities, like on the left, and maybe like just like the really, really prudish right. But I think beyond that, it's just good fun, and it's not subversive at all. There's much worse subversive messaging out there. And I'd say, honestly, any movie where it's this Chad, patriotic, intelligent, white man going off and fighting baddies and saving the world, I'm perfectly fine with that. I'm not going to complain about any of that. I mean, I'm not going to complain about that.
I mean, people in the chat are saying, like, aren't the British intelligence services, like, still good? Yeah, they are. The problem is they're coming after people like me. if the actual real equivalent of James Bond now is probably snooping through this stream to see if I slip up on a hate speech infraction or something like that. I mean, in fairness, I'm being a little bit harsh, you know. I'll probably end up having a poison umbrella stuck on my leg next time I go shopping or something. But in reality, yeah, they probably will be in Ukraine. But the British sort of deep state is absolutely cancerous. I was watching this, and there's a scene when Bond is walking along at the port, having a little conversation with M, and they're talking about what the sort of the policies are going to be and dealing with these threats and all of that. And I thought, from the perspective today, like, if you're going to talk about how James Bond is like morally subversive, like, I find that kind of boring. But what I do find interesting is the idea that all of this intelligence kind of deep state shenanigans, which we were told was this was all supposed to be a conspiracy theory before the era of Trump. The idea was that we lived in representative democracies, and the people were sovereign, and we had say over everything that the government is getting up to. And yet here you've got like James Bond 60 odd years ago, and there's all of this shady crap going on, defending the interests of the British state. And at least with Roger Moore, you get the sense that he is a patriot. You do with Sean Connery as well, but especially with Roger Moore. But when you get into later, when you get in with Daniel Craig, it's kind of like it's not really like that. It's more like the British state and the intelligence services, and for the CIA, because they're frequently, you know, there's not really any difference. I mean, at least we can say, well, the Soviet Union just didn't present itself as a democracy. And you had their intelligence assets could go over and do whatever they wanted, and on behalf of the Communist Party, whatever. The KGB, but in when you've got a liberal democracy, how there's a very kind of dark thing there, which when for us now being like sort of realists about how our power functions, and you realize democracy's a bit of a joke, really. You can actually go back and look at James Bond and think they were telling you this all along. There's no democratic oversight happening here whatsoever.
He literally has a license to kill.
He's kind of like, he can come and kill you on behalf of the state. And it's funny because we're told that the deep state. I know I'm repeating myself, but you know, we were told that the deep state, there's no such thing as a deep state. And you've had like decades and decades of these glamorous sort of spy-driven dramas all about like all the shady shit that the actual, you don't have to, the deep state sounds a bit kind of overblown and a bit hyped. But let's just say the intelligence services, like what is it that they're actually doing? And one of the long-running tropes in all of the different spy stuff, I've read quite a few John le Carré novels back in the day, and I watched the series, and obviously there's James Bond as well, and something like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. And in the John le Carré ones, it's much more sort of grotty and mundane than what James Bond is. It'll be people like meeting up and passing each other a document in a crappy cafe somewhere, you know, where they're having like a cheap fry up, and people will be dressed in rain macks, and there's no babes in it or anything. Well, I think there is one in Tinker Tailor, I think it was the little drummer girl has a bit of a babe at the center of it. But what I'm kind of getting at here is that in the world of the intelligence services, it's as if they're kind of interacting and doing things with each other, which has just got nothing to do with the main population at all. It's they're in this very dark, they're in the shadows, you know, as Judi Dench says on Skyfall, which I watched the other day, They're very much operating in the shadows. There's no democratic accountability whatsoever. So somebody somewhere, these directors of these agencies have got an enormous amount of power at their disposal, and none of it has anything to do with being liberal and democratic.
Well, I mean, another thing with James Bond is that it kind of makes you feel okay with that. Because if your image is Roger Moore going off and fighting some guys in jumpsuits who are trying to blow up the world, you kind of actually feel okay with the fact that, yeah, you know, it's not entirely democratic, but they got men out there like James Bond who are going out there and making sure that we're safe at home and fighting the terrorists or the shady Spectre organization or the Soviet Union or whoever it is, whoever may threaten our safety and our way of life, James Bond will go out there and kick their ass and save the world. It actually kind of makes you feel a lot more comfortable with the idea that there could be this spy who has who is licensed to kill, who's literally allowed to kill people on behalf of the British state and face no consequences for it. I think that now I like Daniel Craig. I haven't seen the recent one. I didn't watch the his final Bond movie. I heard it wasn't as woke as the early promos made it out to be, but I just couldn't get interested in it. And I do like Daniel Craig. I think he's a great actor, and I like a few of the films he was in. But I think that one way that it misses in a way that wouldn't call this like the fault of Craig or the filmmakers per se. One way that it misses where the Connery or Roger Moore films don't. There's the scenes at the beginning, usually when he goes into the office, he in London, he says he has some banter with Moneypenny and maybe throws his hat onto the, something I noticed, I can't remember which one it was in, but Connery always wore a hat and he would throw it onto the hook in the office. They had a scene of Roger Moore walking in and throwing the hat onto the hook, but he never actually wore the hat. So, well, whatever. That's not important. But you get the idea that on the streets of London, things are going to be nice. You know, you get the idea that England is actually a nice place to live, and that Bond is out there fighting bad guys across the world to keep it a nice place. But I've been to London in the last couple of years. Let's just say I think everyone understands what I mean when I say it's not exactly a nice place to live anymore. And if you have Bond going off fighting guys around the world and that's what it's in defense of, it kind of just takes away the heroism, because you don't feel like Bond's going to go off and save the day and we can all sleep sound at night knowing that we have our hero out there fighting the bad guys. Because Daniel Craig, or whoever comes after that, the British state and the society that he's fighting on behalf of, well, it's the British state of the present day. And like you mentioned earlier, he'd probably be going off after people like you, not after anyone that actually poses a threat to the safety of the British people. So I think that it's kind of I feel like that you can't have a character as fun and optimistic as James Bond anymore these days, because the conception of home, which he's out there supposedly defending, it just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, there's almost no aspect in they do have Union Jacks in the Daniel Craig ones, but they're kind of there as an afterthought. And in Skyfall as well, and I just watched that last week, there's a scene when he's written off as dead at the start of it, and he comes back and he breaks into Judi Dench by this point, private apartment. But you do see that London, and it's got, firstly, it's got those nice old-fashioned sort of gently yellow glowing streetlights, you know, with a little hint of fog. So it gives it looks like some rom-com or something from the late 90s, when in actual fact, the lighting now is those horrible kind of bright, what do they call them? Is it the LED things?
LED.
And it gives this kind of creepy minimal space, sort of cold it looks like, you know, like it's like some kind of French existential kind of drama thing, not the kind of soft glow that we used to have on the street. So they're really trying to paint lipstick on the pig there. But it's still the case that as we've moved away, I mean, there was patriotism in the Sean Connery ones as well. But where the rot set in is that I remember on when was the Piers Morgan ones. I hate him. He's on my mind. He's the first thing I say when I think of Piers. Piers Brosnan Bond. Is that there's some scenes in it where Sean Bean's in it as well, and he's an ex-agent.
Is GoldenEye.
Yeah, and he's basically gone rogue on them. And what comes up is that Winston Churchill sent back a load of Russian sort of Amigas. Cossacks. And the idea is that we should feel guilty about that. It isn't that Churchill is a scumbag, because they were all sent back to Stalin and he killed them all. But what they do there is pull a fast one, and they kind of lean into sort of British guilt. And I remember like Judi Dench saying, yeah, it was hardly our most, or James Bond says, yeah, it wasn't exactly our most sort of proudest moment or whatever. And then and this is way before the Daniel Craig ones, and Judi Dench is like, "Oh, you're this misogynist relic of a world that's long gone," and it's a kind of disavowal of the Roger Moore and Sean Connery era of Bonds, and what they're signalling there is that well, the times have changed and we're politically correct now, but it wasn't as advanced where you had like woke. But it was there. It was there creeping in, because already in the 90s there was like James Bond seemed to be kind of anachronistic. It seemed to be old fashioned. It seemed to be out of kilter with modern liberal values, precisely because it leaned into things like patriotism, which by the 90s was becoming cringe, and it was seen as being racist and misogynistic and all the rest of it. And another thing they did was make Piers Brosnan kind of have more, he was much more emotional as well. And so you can see that all of these things were being signaled way back then. And obviously it got much worse when Daniel Craig came in, even though that was, I think Skyfall is a great film. But it was all a far cry from Roger Moore. Well, Roger Moore's of that kind of identity.
Oh, sorry, you cut out for a second there. Could you repeat that last sentence?
What you can look at the Roger Moore and the earlier Bonds, and then the more you can see the political correctness coming in the 90s, and in something like The Spy Who Loved Me, you can see that what they're doing is undercutting the kind of gentle patriotism of those films. And eventually, it brings us all the way back to the main point. And it's that if you are operating outside of democratic norms, nobody's got any oversight on these committees, these bureaucracies, these intelligence services, then if they're now severed from the well-being of the people and the general good of a nation, what is it that they're actually for? What is it that they're actually getting up to? Now, one of the reasons I say that I like the Daniel Craig Bonds is because they do actually pose these questions themselves, and I've got takes on that. I think that would be getting off the subject a little bit. But there's a lot of it in there that's saying, "Well, we don't need you anymore because it's all online, it's all digital. We don't need a man with a gun, hiding in the shadows anymore when we can do everything much more efficiently with public-private partnerships." And it's all about like millionaires with laptops buying up green energy shit in Peru, water supplies in Peru. It's really surprising how much strange things like that are in the Daniel Craig Bonds, but that's maybe for another day.
Yeah, with I mean, maybe we can even do a stream on one of the Craig movies in the future. One thing I wanted to say about the Moore films in particular, though, is that one thing that stood out to me, both in this one, but even more so in the movie Octopussy. So in The Spy Who Loved Me, at the beginning of the movie, so there's kind of like this rivalry between XXX and 007 at the beginning of the movie, because they're both going after that the designs of the submarine tracking device. And they're chasing each other through Egypt. They're both trying to buy the device from the same guy. Jaws kills the guy. Then he takes it and takes it away. They both have to go after Jaws and like trying to like ditch the other one and leave Jaws to kill him or her while they get off with it. And then, but then, you know, the second and third act of the movie, they kind of come together when they realize, okay. So when the British realize, okay, the Russians did not steal our sub. The Russians realize it wasn't the British who sold our sub. Who stole our sub? What's going on here? Let's like put our heads together and try to figure out, because you know we have these two nuclear subs missing. This is a big problem, and we need to figure out what's going on. And that gets you into the second, and then later the third act of the movie, where they, where the British Americans side with the Soviets to fight Strongberg, kind of this rogue billionaire megalomaniac. There's this ties in with the character of General Gogol, who was in, like I mentioned earlier, who was in a lot of the Bond movies of the era. And he's not like a villain. He's kind of just the representative of the Soviet Union. There's this understanding that while the West, in this case, Britain and the Soviet Union are geopolitical rivals, they kind of both, they kind of have this mutual respect for each other. So the idea is that, okay, we're not going to blow each other up. We're going to try to avoid that at all costs. These are our interests. These are yours. How can we manage this? I wanted to bring up the movie Octopussy as well, because this was two films later. And the plot in Octopussy is that there's a rogue Soviet general who thinks that the Warsaw Pact can take Western Europe. So the only issue that he has is the nuclear weapons that Western Europe has. So he thinks that if his plot, his scheme is that he's going to stage a nuclear accident in West Germany. And then this is going to convince the West that they need to embark on a campaign of nuclear disarmament, because these nukes are more danger, that they're doing more harm than good. So he's trying to trick them into thinking this by staging a nuclear disaster in West Germany. And from that, once the West has disarmed their nuclear arsenal, the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact can roll across Western Europe and take the entire thing. That's the scheme of the villain. But what stood out to me so much with that scheme is his entire plan was entirely contingent on the West, that being his adversaries, being objective about this. So what he thought was, they're going to do an investigation. They're going to realize that the Soviet Union didn't launch this weapon and that it was an accident. And therefore, they're going to come to the conclusion that they should embark on this campaign of nuclear disarmament. It doesn't seem to be in his mind that maybe they're just going to use this as an excuse to launch their own weapons, and they're not even going to care about the truth at all. And the reason that this stood out to me so much is that the world we live in today, it truly is like a post-truth world. And I feel that the more Bond movies were made in a world in which truth still mattered. Now, I know it's a James Bond movie. I know it's outlandish. I know it's not a realistic plot in any way, shape, or form. However, the underlying like assumption that these rival power blocks would actually be objective about something, and that they wouldn't just simply use any kind of event in the world for their own political gains, regardless of the truth, that really stood out to me. Because like, if something like that happened today, so like, let's say, for example, some nuclear sub went missing today, it could be a Russian one, could be an American one, or whatever. I have no faith that the people who are in charge today are going to be objective about it and actually try to like figure out what happened. I'll give you two examples of this. So, and from both sides. When Hillary Clinton lost the 2016 U.S. election to Donald Trump, they had this. They came out with this baseless conspiracy theory that the Russians hacked the election in some way, and that there must have been some kind of meddling. And they had no proof of that. They never once produced anything to verify that. But it was kind of just like a way of pushing it off onto your enemy. and regardless of what was actually true. And then on the flip side, when there was that terrorist attack in Moscow in March of this year, the Russians came out and said, well, the CIA and the MI6 must have planned this thing, even though, again, there's no evidence that they did. They even warned them that it would be happening ahead of time. And before anyone comments that, that means that they must have planned it. Well, Iran did the same thing. So in order to believe that the CIA and MI6 planned that attack, you'd have to believe that Iran was also in on it, which is pretty ridiculous. But what you notice with all these events, like another example is the Nord Stream pipeline. Now, obviously that was blown up by either the United States or Britain or someone associated with NATO. But in the Western media, it's just like, oh, well, we don't know what happened. We think that the Russians did it, even though, the narrative, I guess, is that they blew up a pipeline, which they spent billions and billions of dollars building when they could just turn off the switch, when they control the switch. I mean, so my point is that in the world that we live in today, truth doesn't matter at all. So all of these plots that these villains are plotting in the Roger Moore movies on the backdrop of the Cold War, they all have this assumption that these power blocks are actually going to be objective. Whereas I have no faith of that happening at all these days. I think it was you that wrote a post on Telegram a while back that it was that one day I think that Ukraine like blew up the bridge to Crimea, and then there were a bunch of people on Twitter bragging about it and gloating about the bridge being blown up. And then when Russia launched a bunch of strikes the next day, the same people were then claiming that the same people who were gloating about it the day before were then claiming that the attack was just a it was a false flag so that they could justify the missile launches. So it feels like today everyone kind of interprets all of reality through the lens of their preconceived like political ideologies, both geopolitical powers and people on the internet as well. And I don't get the sense that that's the case in this era that the Moore films don't reflect like such a post-truth world like we live in today.
No, and I think that comes in with Piers Brosnan a little bit, because you had Tomorrow Never Dies, and the main plot is where the bad guy owns a satellite media company, and he's going to manipulate the West into going to war with China, just purely through, he's just a media baron. And it, obviously Bond gets called in to investigate it and find out what's going on. And I think what's interesting there is after the Cold War, and you get into the Piers Brosnan era, they're struggling to have a kind of a background. As I was saying earlier, it's nice and it's when it's the Cold War and things are set. You know which side which is on, you know what they represent and whatnot. You know, leaving aside the skullduggery of the intelligence services, as a narrative, you know, well, there's some people on the Soviet side, there's some people on the Western side. And when you kind of get into the unipolar world, it's the question that I think the West asked, and the James Bond movies of the era, was like, what now? What is the threat of the future? What does this play out to the background to? And so one of the earlier ones is in Tomorrow Never Dies, which I don't think it's one of the better Bonds. But then it's like, well, we've got, everybody's got all these satellite media channels, which was the thing. And then when you get into the Daniel Craig era, it's the internet. And it's how people have got so much power of the internet that this, it forms the back. That's the sort of the through line, is technology undermining security all the way through the Daniel Craig movies. And it's no surprise that there's one of them features global warming, and it's these kind of technocrats buying up water supplies and whatnot through like a kind of net zero scam as well. That's Quantum of Solace. And then you've got this idea that the intelligence services themselves are going to be bought up by a private corporation, which is all part of Spectre, of course. And all of the information and the data will end up in their hands because they could do a better job than the actual sort of state. And then in the last movie, you've got like a virus gets loose and cause havoc. So they're very kind of reflective of the eras that they're living. I completely agree with it.
Well, speaking of that, I know it's a bit off topic, but the movie The Living Daylights, this one came out in 1987. So this was one of the only two with Timothy Dalton. I remember the Rambo stream that we did, and we got to Rambo 3, and it's basically just neocon propaganda, and they dedicate the movie to the Mujahideen fighting in Afghanistan, which would be really ironic a few years later. They did the same thing with The Living Daylights, which came out two years earlier. They had a James Bond end up in in Afghanistan, and then ends up siding with the Mujahideen to fight against the Soviets, which I guess that's another thing that I know that the Cold War kind of like heated up a bit in the 1980s, and the mutual understanding that they portray in the Spy Who Loved Me, that was kind of gone by then, and it was more, and they were kind of back to just being the out and out bad guys again. It's just kind of funny that you really see the politics of that year on display as you did in Rambo 3. So, and then that would have been the last Bond film to be released. I guess before there was one that came out in 1989, but whatever. In GoldenEye, which is the first Pierce Brosnan one, that part of the plot is the fall of the Soviet Union. So he goes to post-Soviet St. Petersburg and drives a tank through St. Petersburg. I really like that movie, is even though it does have some subversive elements that you mentioned in it. But yeah, you do see that Bond moves with the times. That and to their credit, I mean, at least with the Daniel Craig ones, it's not like some racist white supremacist that he's going off and fighting. It's actually like some big technocrat, which, you know, in many ways is actually reflective of the world we live in.
In Skyfall, I do think Skyfall is a great film, even though it's just pretty much a sort of Dark Knight ripoff. I do think it's a good film, and the general theme of that, which I think why I like it, I even like the Adele song. But I mean, I'm probably going to lose some of my my social status because I've just said that it'll be clipped. But yeah, I think even the Adele song's decent. But the main theme of it is that James Bond is getting old. He's out of place. He's, you know, he's lost his touch. And there's all of these little themes popping up. There's all of these little motifs that keep popping up. And basically, it's because the MI6, or is it MI5? Which one is it? They can't actually compete in the new digital world. And that results in, they literally go off grid. They literally, and the only gadget he has is like a little transponder beeper thing, or from dating back all the way back to the Sean Connery. The original Aston Martin comes back into it as well. And then they go into the old world. They go up into the Highlands of Scotland for an old-fashioned shootout. And I thought that's it is, because that kind of thing is in the zeitgeist, you know, that it is people becoming a bit wary of data collection and manipulation through targeted advertisements at our level. But within the security services, yeah, you can imagine what they're having to deal with. And I, for that, at least, I can kind of appreciate the vibe of it all, because it's certainly how I feel. But then you can't help but feel that it's also poor-faced and humorless, you know. And if the different eras and the different decades of James Bond reflect sort of, you know, the 70s or the 60s or the 80s or whatever, like the bleakest that we have are the Daniel Craig ones. They're almost entirely humorless. You know, they've deliberately got political correctness. They've deliberately got, they're breaking the frame because there's obviously diversity hires in there and all of this kind of thing. And you just, so when you look back at The Spy Who Loved Me or Connery Bond or Octopussy or View to a Kill, you get this kind of warm, nostalgic glow, which they just can't, there's something lost. And what's funny is that in the future, if you did like a huge binge of all the James Bond movies, like this era we're in now would come across as the bleakest, even though in the 1970s, the 60s and the 80s, people were literally staring in the face of nuclear war. And you think, wouldn't that be a really bad time? Wouldn't it be really serious and all these existential questions? And it isn't. And I think you're right. I think it's because the motives of each side were understood, and each side was understood to be rational and reasonable. And it's like in post-modernity, you don't have that assurance anymore, because you're not actually sure what the foundations are. You're not actually sure what's solid under your feet anymore. And you get this kind of moral relativism creeping in of what you see in something like the Craig movies.
I mean, one thing I don't like about a lot of modern movies is I find like The Dark Knight was what kind of set the tone for this, which was a great movie, don't get me wrong. But it feels like today everything has to be down in the dumps and gritty and has to have this like slate, like depressing grayish color to it. Like the movie The Road, which I really liked as well. But I don't like that every movie feels like it has to be that these days. Although with the Craig movies, I do think that it kind of does fit the era, because let's say that they tried to make Daniel Craig's Bond into Roger Moore's, where he's this, this patriotic, like a gentlemanly, witty, witty guy. Well, I don't think it would work, because I mean, what would he have to be patriotic about? So in some ways that it's kind of fitting that Daniel Craig's Bond is a lot more cynical, because he's just like, okay, let's get this over with. I gotta go shoot these guys for that stupid M back in London who's gonna nag me and call me a sexist or whatever. It feels like it's a lot more of a chore for him. And I imagine that that's probably how it would be working for one of these managerial bureaucracies today, because what would he actually have to be patriotic about? Like, I couldn't imagine Daniel Craig's Bond, having the Union Jack as his parachute, because you know, I don't feel like he's quite that enthusiastic about skiing off for king and country because England needs him like Roger Moore's Bond was. So in some ways, that it's actually fitting.
Yeah, he's a glorified bureaucrat. That's what it is. That's what these intelligence agencies are now. And I think if you have the Daniel Craig ones and it's set to the backdrop of this kind of the uncertainty and creep of the digital realm, now that we're like you've got actual full blown geopolitical meltdown back on the menu, which came in just after the end of Craig's tenure, there's going to be more Bond movies coming up, and they're going to somehow address the situation with Putin. They won't touch what's happening with Israel and Gaza. They'll just pretend that doesn't exist or anything. But I think they will have to have a few sort of nods and winks towards Putin, because in a weird way, we're back where we were all the way back, say, at the beginning of Connery's Bond movies. But this time, because like what you were saying, the media's crazy, we've ended up where Putin would have to be depicted as like a Bond villain, but with the biggest country on earth. Like they've already painted Putin out to be not just the mid-century Austrian painter, but in a kind of way like an actual Bond villain. Like, so they're going to have to somehow top that. And what would his mission be? What will James Bond's mission be? And if the next movie comes out in like 2026 or whatever, is he going to be on a spying mission in the Baltics and getting up to mischief with a Russian agent? And what will the Russian agents be like in this era? No, I mean, will he be having like, will there be like another Anya? Will there be like a sexy Russian girl who he has a dalliance with? Because they would have to say, well, what is the politics of Russia? What is the politics of the Soviet Union? And I thought it would be interesting if they even dared, or they could just lean in to this kind of infantile sort of trend that we're on. But yeah, the James Bond, there'll be a new James Bond coming, and he's coming back at an era when there's geopolitical tension. You could even bring China into it. Is there going to be like a Chinese element with, you know, are we going to have like a chase along the Siberian? Russia's smuggling something delicate into China. Like, would they even do that? It's interesting to think about. What will be the next era of Bond in the world that we've got in the 2020s? Like, properly into them, you know?
I don't know. I don't have much faith in it. I don't have much faith in it actually being good. That's all I can say.
So, Joe in the chat says that the main mission will be to get a like save Hunter Biden's laptop. James Bond will have to like break into a whorehouse in Ukraine or something like that. Is that what it's going to be like? Will it be there's some like delicate file from BlackRock floating around in Taiwan, and James Bond has to parachute in there on behalf of Larry Fink to get this delicate information out of the hands of the Chi-Coms? This is like what they're going to have to lean into, because the assumption that the West was good is kind of falling apart. So a new era of Bond would have to sort of, it would have to mean that the West was good. And how are they going to do that? How are they going to present the West? Unless it's this whole thing of putting the woke away, Donald Trump comes back in, and we get this kind of sort of synthetic, patriotic, center-right sort of thing happening across the West, and they'll use James Bond as a vehicle to kind of compound that as well. And it'll not be... I mean, it would kind of survive how politically correct it's been now. Maybe there'll be some anti-woke jokes in there. But what it would do would be to create this theme of the West being worth defending, and that the people who were defending the West against Putin and the Chinese and the Iranians and all this, like, we are still the good guys. You know, I just don't know. I just think that's a difficult sell these days, because they've thoroughly deconstructed the entire culture and told us we're evil. Even the Pierce Brosnan's once did that. It was an extent.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do with the series next, but you know, I am. Well, I think that what everyone's holding their breath on is who is actually going to be cast as James Bond. Because let's be honest, if they go in a diverse direction, well, then we can basically just write the next movie off as trash. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I kind of also am kind of worried that it'll just be one of like this, just like over the top propaganda or something like that, where either it's going to be like extremely woke, or it'll just kind of be like this cartoonish, like evil guy wants to blow up the world. I know that James Bond, it typically tends to be that, but I'd like it to not like be too much. I'd like it to not be too on the nose. So like, you know, I just hope that they don't like have like the villain be like some populist leader who's going to take over some country in Europe and then destroy our democracy or something like that, because I could see them going in that direction. And yeah, if that were the case, it'd just be trash.
Yeah that would be awful. That would be absolutely awful. Like James Bond hunts down like far right nationalist sort of organization or something. That would be terrible. That would be absolutely terrible. It would be like, because James, you know, when you look at all the other franchises that have gone down in flames, being touched by the idiots who are writing scripts these days and the DEI and all of that, James Bond, yeah, there's been complaints. He's got out of it. You know, there's been some clunkers, especially in the Daniel Craig ones, but he kind of got through it. I think if they don't have a white James Bond, you're already talking disaster alone. But we'll see. It depends on where this whole thing with the DEI is going, I suppose. I mean, one take that I saw going around was that there was talk of like having James Bond a period piece. So you would set it back in the 60s, sort of back during the Cold War, which is terrible, because it means they just don't know how to represent the age that we're in. They have to go back. On the other hand, if you do that, you can probably have less diversity in it. Although, well, yeah, I'm not even sure. I doubt that either, actually. But I suppose we'll see. Yeah. Any final parting shots?
No, maybe just check the super chats before we finish.
I haven't got any. There's none. There's none. Not a one. Not a single one. But all right, this is me classic movies as it's just a cozy Sunday afternoon stream anyways. But thanks for tuning in, and folks, well, have you got any idea what you want to cover next week?
I'm thinking of doing High Noon next.
Oh, all right. All right. Well, we'll have some deep dives on that one. I'll have to do a little bit of swatting up. All right. Thanks for tuning in, folks. And I'll see you next time.